Psychics. Tens of millions of Americans and billions worldwide believe in strange mental powers that the scientific process has been unable to confirm. According to a Gallup poll, 41% of American adults believe in ESP, 31% believe in telepathy, and 21% believe that some people can communicate with the dead. They embrace these claims despite the failure of everyone who has ever tried to prove any of it. Apparently, people are sufficiently impressed by the work of professional psychics, mind readers with knowledge of the future, and mediums, live people who talk with dead people. But there are very simple explanations for how psychics and mediums are able to impress so many people. For example, a cold reading can exploit natural human biases and lead some people to believe that there is something supernatural going on when there is not. I was so intrigued by this that I decided to give it a try. Although I had read enough about cold readings to know how they work, I was still hesitant. The method requires you to use educated guesses about a person for you to convince her that you are peering into her mind. At the very least, it takes a lot of nerve to sit face to face with someone and pretend to read his or her mind. It's useful to know many trends and traits that are common to various people, genders, religions, nationalities, ages, and so on. It also helps to be able to think fast and make immediate adjustments based on real-time reactions and feedback from the subject. Researching cold readings is one thing. Actually doing one, however, is something entirely different. But I wanted to at least try, so I plunged in. My first client is a woman in her mid-30s. She's bright, attractive, and most importantly tells me she thinks there is something to psychic powers. She is predisposed to believe me. That's about 80% of the battle won right there because prior beliefs and expectations are known to be powerful influences on how we interpret our experiences. My confidence soars. She stares, waiting for me to start. I speak slowly and pause a lot, hoping this makes me seem sure of myself. I spend a few moments blabbing about nothing, mostly empty words about me feeling her thoughts and how I need her to relax and open up to me. I begin the actual cold reading by peppering her with several rapid-fire statements and questions. While doing this, I pay close attention to her eyes, facial expressions, and body language. I look for any reaction to each thing I say. I notice she is not wearing a wedding ring. Sure enough, she lights up with heightened interest when I blurt out something about frustration with her love life. She's in her 30s, and I guessed that marriage might be on her mind. Her reaction indicates to me that I should zero in on this subject, so I pretend to know all about boyfriends who have disappointed her in the past, as if that makes her unique. Once I feel I've gone as far as I can with made-up predictions and crude generalizations that would fit many women, I move on to money. I tell her she's not greedy, but could use a little more. Then I add in something about just wanting to be a good person and lead a happy life. Overall, I'm feeling pretty good about my performance. But is she buying it? Does she think I'm reading her mind and can see her future? Maybe. I'm not sure. I keep going. I try to ask questions and make statements that have a good chance of feeling personal and relevant to her based on her gender, age, nationality, religion, and so on. I mix in a few flattering comments. It's surprising how many clues one can pick up when reading the mind of a person sitting 2 feet in front of you. She smiles when I say something that hits, and she appears neutral or uncomfortable when I clearly miss the mark. It's as easy as that. I end by giving her a cliché-filled pep talk. Your future is bright. Try your best. Never give up. When I finish, she thanks me but leaves abruptly. That's it. Show's over. I'm left deflated and disappointed. I conclude that I somehow blew it. Maybe cold readings are a lot more difficult than I thought. Somewhere, Sylvia Brown and a million spirits are laughing at me. But I see the woman a couple of days later, and she approaches me. How did you do that the other day? She asks. It was amazing. How long have you been a psychic? You knew so much about me. Wow, clearly I did better than I thought. She was completely convinced. Of course, I quickly explained to her that I did not have any special mind-reading powers, and that I was attempting a cold reading just to see if I could do it. I apologized and said I would have explained it that day, but didn't think she believed me, so it wasn't necessary. The woman was a bit unsettled at first, but as I told her more about how it works and explained confirmation bias, she seemed grateful for the knowledge. The lesson I took away from that experience is that it doesn't take much to convince someone. If I could do this well on my first try, it's no wonder that some people who spend years perfecting this routine are able to convince many people and get rich. This was a stunning realization for me. I had stumbled through a performance that was mediocre at best, but it turned out to be more than good enough. How did I do so well? She believed in psychics to some degree beforehand, so was predisposed to accept my act. She also was a human with a human brain. This means, of course, as we heard in Chapter 2, that she was vulnerable to confirmation bias. Like all victims of cold readings, she probably clung to and remembered everything I said about her that was correct, or close enough because it reinforced her belief in psychics. But she probably missed or soon forgot everything I said that was clearly wrong because my errors did not confirm her bias. Then her memory probably helped me out by exaggerating how good I was every time she recalled our session. It's important to understand confirmation bias and be alert to it all the time because it can trip up people not only during a psychic reading but in the context of many other extraordinary claims as well. When we selectively embrace input that matches a conclusion we have already made, virtually anything can seem real and reasonable, regardless of how fake and unreasonable it is. It's like throwing 1,000 darts in the dark and then turning on the lights to find that you hit the bullseye 10 times. Hitting a target 10 times in the dark might seem very impressive, but only if you ignore, forget, or never see those 990 darts that missed. When a psychic says 100 things, we can't allow ourselves to take note only of the correct things and forget all about the incorrect things, he says. And we can't give credit for vague statements and questions. We need to keep score in order to determine if there is anything to this or if it's just a bunch of semi-educated guesses designed to fool people. And don't forget sample size. We can't restrict ourselves to considering only one or two individual readings when assessing a psychic. If a psychic does hundreds of readings, for example, it is to be expected that at least a few might go exceptionally well and appear to be eerily accurate. However, placed in proper context with all the readings that go poorly, it's not impressive. I have a friend who was good enough at psychic readings to make money at it. He wasn't a cold-hearted con artist, nor was he doing it as a noble experiment toward a better understanding of the human mind. He was self-deluded, fully convinced that he possessed special powers. But even as the cash rolled in and clients raved about his abilities, he began to have doubts. He noticed that he got credit for making guesses about people, things anyone could come up with. Eventually, he stopped believing not only in his own psychic powers, but in all supernatural and paranormal claims. Today, he is a good skeptic and big fan of the scientific process. He stressed to me how easy it was to fool people, including himself. Operating much like psychics, mediums claim to carry on two-way conversations with dead people. Many psychics are mediums as well, which makes sense because it's the same game. They blast out a bunch of guesses, questions, and platitudes about a dead person, and then watch to see what gets a reaction from the surviving spouse, family member, or friend. He's here with us now, and he tells me to tell you that he loves you and is proud of you for doing your best in life. He also said he likes that you keep a photo of him. He says keep working hard and believe in yourself. A good skeptic sees right through this. For some grieving people, however, it can be irresistible. It's understandable to want to communicate or connect with someone who is gone, but that desire should not override the ability we all possess to think our way through things like this. No one should allow himself or herself to be emotionally exploited and toyed with, even if it does feel good for a fleeting moment. The bottom line with psychics and mediums is that their claims can be tested. There is a way to confirm once and for all if people can peer into the mind of a stranger, living or dead, and know intimate details about his past, present, and future. If psychics are interested, science can confirm their abilities to the world. All they have to do is submit to the process. It is telling that very few do. If psychics and mediums are not sufficiently motivated by the prospect of scientific confirmation for the sake of truth, one might think that money would do the trick. The James Randi Educational Foundation has a standing $1 million prize available to anyone who can demonstrate a paranormal supernatural ability under the conditions of a credible scientific test that she or he can design. But for reasons one can easily imagine, today's best-known psychics and mediums don't even try. They declare that they can read minds and glean knowledge from dead people, but then leave $1 million on the table. Hopefully, you will be too good a skeptic to fall for the games psychics and mediums play, but you are bound to know someone who believes. Tell that person about me. Tell her the story about the guy who, on his first try, was able to fumble and stumble his way through a short, cold reading and convince a smart adult that he was a mind reader. If that guy can do it, anyone can. So keep your guard up. The Roswell UFO Crash. Without a doubt, the best UFO story of all time is the one about an extraterrestrial spaceship crashing in the desert near the tiny town of Roswell, New Mexico, in the summer of 1947. This was no mere sighting of a strange light in the sky. No, this time we had confirmation from the U.S. military, recovered wreckage, and maybe even the dead bodies of aliens to prove it. Roswell is the holy grail of UFO belief, but there's one catch. It's almost certainly not true. Don't get me wrong, I love the Roswell incident, But I know better than to accept it because I have studied the claims and the facts, spoken with a test pilot who may have inadvertently contributed to the myth, and considered how the tale works so well with the human propensity to believe without evidence. That is not to say, however, that there isn't a true story to be told here. Roswell believers are right about a few key elements. Something unusual did crash in the desert, strange wreckage was recovered, and there really was a government cover-up about it. It all started when local rancher Mac Brazel found debris in the desert outside of Roswell in June 1947. He assumed it was just trash and moved on. Not the reaction one would expect if it was a crashed flying vehicle of any kind. Several days later, a private pilot named Ken Arnold reported seeing weird objects while flying in the Pacific Northwest, far from Roswell. He described the objects as flat and shaped something like boomerangs, but the term flying saucer was widely reported in the media, and that's what stuck with the U.S. public. It is interesting to think that more accurate reporting of Arnold's sighting would have led to the flying boomerang craze of the 1950s instead of flying saucers, and all those black-and-white sci-fi B-movies of the era would have depicted flying boomerangs terrorizing the Earth. In the wake of the Arnold story, thousands of people across America made UFO reports in the following months and years. The UFO era had taken flight, and it likely influenced the events at Roswell. Some 3 weeks after he found the wreckage, Brazel drove into town where he might have heard about Arnold's UFO sighting or other flying saucer stories. Regardless, for one reason or another, Brazel now felt that what he found might be important, so he reported it to Roswell's sheriff, who in turn alerted the nearby Roswell Army airfield. Personnel from the base recovered the materials, and then the story really took off because an enthusiastic public information officer issued a press release claiming that a flying disc had been recovered. Soon after that, the Roswell Daily Record newspaper carried a lead story about it with this headline, RAAF Captures Flying Saucer in Roswell Region. It's worth noting that in those days, flying saucer or flying disc didn't necessarily mean alien spacecraft to people the way it does today. So maybe the press release wasn't quite as overreaching then as it seems to us today. A very important point in all of this is that immediate descriptions of the material by Brazel, the original discoverer, seem to make it clear that this was absolutely not the remains of a spaceship from an advanced extraterrestrial civilization. The following excerpts are from a front-page report printed on July 9, 1947, in the Roswell Daily Record on page 1, just one day after the original flying disc story. Wilcox, Roswell sheriff, got in touch with the Roswell Army airfield, and Major Jesse A. Marcel and a man in plain clothes accompanied him home, where they picked up the rest of the pieces of the disc and went to his home to try to reconstruct it. According to Brazel, they simply could not reconstruct it at all. They tried to make a kite out of it, but could not do that, and could not find any way to put it back together so that it could fit. Brazel said that he did not see it fall from the sky, and did not see it before it was torn up, so he did not know the size or shape it might have been, but he thought it might have been about as large as a tabletop. The balloon which held it up, if that was how it worked, must have been about 12 feet long, he felt, measuring the distance by the size of the room in which he sat. The rubber was smoky gray in color and scattered over an area about 200 yards in diameter. When the debris was gathered up, the tinfoil, paper, tape, and sticks made a bundle about 3 feet long and 7 or 8 inches thick, while the rubber made a bundle about 18 or 20 inches long and about 8 inches thick. In all, he estimated, the entire lot would have weighed maybe 5 pounds. There was no sign of any metal in the area, which might have been used for an engine, and no sign of any propellers of any kind, although at least one paper fin had been glued onto some of the tinfoil. There were no words to be found anywhere on the instrument, although there were letters on some of the parts. Considerable scotch tape and some tape with flowers printed upon it had been used in the construction. No strings or wire were to be found, but there were some eyelets in the paper to indicate that some sort of attachment may have been used. This is based on reporting that was done very recent to the event, which makes it far more reliable than the extraordinary recollections that would come many years later. Did you notice the absence of any talk about dead alien bodies in or around the wreckage? Don't you think something like that would have been prominent on the mind of Brazel and others? But they seem concerned only with rubber, string, and scotch tape. Another key detail is that the men tried to construct a kite out of the materials. They failed, but their attempt says everything we need to know about what planet this wreckage likely came from. Clearly, they did not see this as the remains of a spacecraft. Just imagine if you found a crashed space shuttle in the desert. What are the odds that your first impulse would be to reconstruct a kite out of the debris? While I am sure that any species capable of traveling to Earth from another world would be significantly more advanced than we are, it's doubtful that they would be so smart as to be able to make it here on a vehicle constructed out of rubber and wood and held together by glue and tape. Continuing with the story, the materials were then flown to Fort Worth Army Base in Texas, where people there immediately recognized what it was. They took one look at the paper, foil, rubber, and balsa wood sticks and issued an official report declaring that it was nothing more than debris from a downed weather balloon. That's it. Case closed. Most people accepted that and forgot about it, until the Roswell crash myth grew many years later. But there is more to the original story. The military lied. Yes, there really was a Roswell cover-up. Today, the whole truth is known, and it's clear that Brazel did not find the remains of a mere weather balloon. Sadly, however, the real story doesn't include aliens crashing on Earth. This probably explains why it's not nearly as popular as that other Roswell story. The only thing the military was honest about was the balloon part of their explanation. What they left out is that this balloon was far more interesting and unusual than some run-of-the-mill weather balloon. The debris was almost certainly from one of the many balloon-supported listening devices used in Project Mogul. This top-secret program utilized many large balloons that rose to extremely high altitudes. In some configurations, multiple balloons were connected by cord to form vast flight trains. Electronic listening devices were attached to a trailing cord for detecting the sounds of distant explosions, such as above-ground nuclear bomb tests in the Soviet Union. Remember, this was in the mid to late 1940s. Back then, there were no spy satellites or long-distance supersonic spy planes like the U-2 or the SR-71. But the Cold War was underway and the United States was determined to keep an eye, or ear in this case, on its rival. At this time, the United States was the lone nuclear power and was very concerned about the Soviets getting the bomb. All of this was extremely secret work, so it should surprise no one that the military lied. B.D. Gildenberg, a participant in Project Mogul, says the work was so secret that even many of the people working on the program didn't know its name or completely understand what it was all about. Project Mogul wasn't declassified until 1972. The reason for the extreme secrecy was that the United States didn't want the Soviets to know they were listening, because then they would have begun testing underground and made it much more difficult for the United States to monitor them. Gildenberg is certain that what Brazel found in 1947 was the wreckage from one of the kite-like radar reflectors that also hung below the balloons. These reflectors were designed to enable ground crews to track the balloons with radar. They were constructed out of rubber, balsa wood sticks, paper, foil, tape, and glue. Sound familiar? A big clue that the elaborate Roswell UFO crash story is a made-up tale is the fact that no one in 1947 said anything about seeing an obvious spaceship or alien bodies being recovered and sent to Area 51 for study. All those juicy elements didn't emerge and become standard components of the story until 30 years later. Only after UFO belief grew, Hollywood unleashed its barrage of alien sci-fi films, alien abduction stories were told, and the classic big-head and tiny-body alien became a prominent fixture in pop culture. Did the Roswell story morph into what it is today? Other secret military projects in the region after 1947 may have helped inflate the myth as well. Probably none did this more than the testing of high-altitude ejection systems for pilots. I interviewed former test pilot Joe Kittinger in 2001 about his remarkable aviation career, and he confessed to possibly having played a role in the Roswell myth. He said he and his team dropped short dummies dressed in futuristic-looking flight suits from high altitudes for various experiments and tests. Could local people have mistaken some of these dummies for aliens? Absolutely they did, Kittinger said. These dummies that we dropped from balloons were dressed in silver pressure suits, so they looked unusual. One time, we dropped one, and it fell way up in the mountains. These dummies weighed more than 250 pounds, so how do you carry one out of the mountains? We put it on a stretcher and carried it to the back of an ambulance to take away. Now, if somebody is back in the weeds watching this, they are going to say, wow, look at that alien they have there. We think that a lot of the alien sightings were actually us doing our work with the test dummies. This was several years after the original crash in 1947, however. So how could people remember seeing aliens, dummies, in 1947? Because that's how human memory works. It is well established that the best of us can and do get the timelines of past events confused. It is very easy, natural, you might say, to make the mistake of remembering that something happened 20 years ago when it actually happened only 5 or 10 years ago. It is also very easy for the memory of a real event to be contaminated by fictional information obtained from a movie or a book. And it can feel absolutely accurate, no matter how terribly wrong it is. The Roswell incident enjoyed a burst of renewed media and public attention in 2011, when Annie Jacobson's book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Military Base, was published. Much to the surprise of many readers, her mostly straightforward and credible history of the secret and important work that went on for decades there included a bizarre story about the Roswell crash near the end of the book. According to the claim that Jacobson presents in a manner that seems intended to convince readers, there really was a flying saucer and tiny humanoids really were recovered at the site, but they weren't from outer space. According to Jacobson's unnamed informant, the spaceship was an advanced flying vehicle built by the Soviet Union and sent into American airspace in order to test U.S. defenses and or terrorize the U.S. military in public. The crew was not made up of aliens but of human children who had been surgically and or genetically altered by Soviet scientists to look like big-headed, big-eyed extraterrestrials. Josef Mengele, the infamous doctor who conducted experiments on Jews at Auschwitz during World War II, was in Soviet hands then and helped transform the unfortunate kids into alien invaders. Great story. What is not so great, however, is any suggestion that it should be accepted as reliable or true. An extraordinary story from an anonymous source, no matter how exciting the story may be, is not good evidence, proof, or anything else other than just another tall tale to be added to the billions of others that humans have been telling for millennia. Conspiracy theories. I was fascinated by the speed of the conspiracy theories that were generated after the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in 2012. Within days, if not hours, of the event, claims of lies and cover-ups were flying around the world. An Israeli assassination squad did it to stir up international problems. The U.S. government did it in order to have an excuse to impose radical new gun control laws leading up to the confiscation of all privately owned guns. Against all logic and without good evidence, conspiracy theorists said no children had been killed at the school. There were no grieving parents, no distraught teachers. The people seen on television and interviewed by journalists were crisis actors playing roles designed to dupe us. Sandy Hook, like the Kennedy assassination, the 9/11 attacks, and thousands of other terrible events, will forever have crude, disturbing, and unproven conspiracy theories attached to it. Why does this happen over and over? Why do people believe these kinds of claims? Before analyzing the conspiracy theory phenomenon, it is important to be clear that evil, destructive, and criminal conspiracies are very real. They happen all the time. Of course, groups of people get together to plan and execute bad deeds. We are social creatures, for better and for worse. Both history books and today's headlines offer countless examples of mischief by committee. Most popular conspiracy theories are not like supernatural paranormal claims because they don't seem to contradict what we know about how the natural world works. The problem is that many of us seem to have an irresistible urge or need to have complex and dramatic explanations when bad things happen, even if they lack proof and on the surface appear to be illogical and very unlikely. This should surprise no one. The following standard human characteristics make conspiracy theories of interest to most and irresistible to some. We love stories. Telling stories and listening to stories is a fundamental aspect of being human. We are storytellers. Gossip isn't just fodder for the tabloids and simple minds. Gossip is a crucial glue that binds us to one another. Since deep into prehistory, stories and gossip have been the devices by which we have shared important information, alerted each other of dangers, and inspired one another. One thing all good conspiracy theories have in common is that they are great stories. There usually are victims, villains, secrets, and a chance for justice to prevail, if only enough people will believe the story. We don't like little answers to big questions. It insults our sense of justice to accept that Lee Harvey Oswald, just one man, was able to kill the most powerful man in the world. There must have been many powerful people involved, right? Not necessarily, because human history and contemporary culture are not math equations that must balance in a way that conforms to our subjective tastes. Sometimes unlikely things just happen, and sometimes events violate our perceptions of what is fair and reasonable. Those damn dots again. Not only can we see things that aren't really there by connecting dots that don't really have a connection, we often think that way, too. Our pattern-seeking ways do not end when we stop looking at clouds and ink blots. Sometimes we connect random dots within stories and information, too. With our minds, we seek out links between facts, comments, events, and people. If enough forced connections are made, then a conspiracy may come into focus, whether or not it's really there. Just like our brains create and see the shape of a monster in a passing cloud, many of us create and see a monstrous secret in big events, even though it's not real. Because conspiracies really do happen, it is important for people, skeptics included, to avoid lumping all conspiracy theories together. Many of them deserve a hearing, not only for the sake of fairness, but also to help counter claims of a cover-up. I think it's crucial to continually steer away from emotion and conjecture with these ideas and stay focused on hard evidence. It is amazing what people will think and say when it comes to conspiracy theories. In 2012, I was a guest on the AM radio show Coast to Coast to discuss skepticism in science. We talked about many topics, but the conspiracy stuff generated the weirdest comments in the days and weeks after the show. I received emails and saw web posts that accused me of being a paid stooge of Big Pharma, out to promote profitable vaccines and spread disinformation about alternative medicine. My view that Al-Qaeda was probably responsible for the 9/11 attacks and that the moon landing hoax claim is almost certainly wrong led some to declare that I was obviously a government-paid black operator on a mission to mislead the public. Clearly, some believers have allowed emotion and suspicions to distract them from the need to focus on evidence. However, some conspiracy theorists don't have that problem. They go to extremes with evidence. They have mountains of evidence and will happily bury you with it if you allow them to. In my experience, the proponents of conspiracy theories who do the hard work of accumulating evidence are far from dim. They tend to be bright, energetic thinkers. What they seem not to realize, however, is that conspiracy theories are the near-perfect trap for confirmation bias problems. When one analyzes a complex crime, large organization, or major event, it is all too easy to cherry-pick the data in order to present a lopsided case. I'm not suggesting that they are dishonest. It is only natural to subconsciously do this. Confirmation bias is universal. Conspiracy theorists, no matter how intelligent and how sincere, certainly are not immune to it. The best advice I can offer about conspiracy theories is to keep an open mind, because groups of people, corporations, religious organizations, and governments really are capable of doing just about anything. History proves it, but don't embrace a wild conspiracy claim because you think it could be true or because you feel it should be true. Play hard to get. Hold out for proof. Astrology. Astrology is the claim that bodies out in space influence bodies down here on Earth. This amazing idea has existed for thousands of years. I get conflicting explanations today, however, when I ask believers if these celestial bodies cause our actions or simply foretell what is going to happen without actively causing any of it. Either way, it's fascinating to imagine such a spooky connection with stars and planets. There were times in our past when astrology made sense to even the most educated and enlightened people in many societies. It was viewed as respectable science and a productive means of gathering information. But we have learned a lot about both space and human psychology since the days of ancient Babylon. For example, scientists figured out some time ago that the location of stars and planets show no detectable or measurable impact on the personality and fates of individuals. Really, it's true. Mars and Saturn have nothing to do with whether or not you will get that promotion at work or marry the ideal spouse one day. Venus has no bearing on how high school cheerleading tryouts will turn out for you. Astrology presents us with yet another opportunity to pause and reflect on the profound weirdness of humankind. On one hand, we have come so far. People once looked up at the night sky, saw gods and animals in the stars. They imagined that they cared about us, influenced us, and whispered secrets. Later, we would walk on the moon, land robots on other worlds, peer deep into the universe and time itself with powerful telescopes, and even contemplate the end of this universe. Yet for all the brilliance we have shown, many millions of us still look up and see planets and stars that know the intimate details of personal lives. It is important to be absolutely clear about one thing. Astrology is not scientific. It is not evidence-based. It has never been proven that astrology is able to describe our lives or predict the future, so I don't think it can. But don't take my word for it. Make up your own mind. Beyond the fact that it's unproven, there are two key points that crush the case for astrology. First, its origin reveals just about everything we need to know about how valid it is likely to be. Astrology's earliest beginnings are lost forever in prehistory, but it's not difficult to imagine early humans injecting personal meaning into the visible stars, planets, and the moon. Who can blame them? They knew nothing of astronomy, so the beauty and the mystery painted across a typical night sky could easily have sparked magical thinking. These lights above me must mean something. How could they not? Perhaps I am connected to them. Maybe I should fear them, revere them, or use them to understand the meaning of my life. They must be the key to understanding this confusing world I live in. They are telling me something. History's earliest mentions of astrology came from the Sumerian and Babylonian cultures, stretching back 3,000 to 4,000 years ago. Astrology, in one form or another, has been hugely influential throughout history and is, in some ways, the ancestor of astronomy. Try not to read too much into that, however. It's like saying that primate grooming, the practice of picking and eating lice and ticks off your buddy's hide, is the ancestor of haircuts and shaving. True, perhaps, but not a pastime we necessarily need to hold on to today. In most societies, and for many centuries, everyone from queens and kings to generals and doctors did little without consulting an astrologer. Even in modern times, some of the world's most powerful leaders have been influenced by astrological beliefs. But don't allow yourself to be overly impressed by age and influence. Popularity and some degree of historical impact are not enough to save astrology. The ancient Babylonians never conducted scientific studies that linked personality types to the movements of celestial bodies. The Sumerians did not amass data that correlated past historical events with star positions in a way that could be used to reliably predict future historical events. No, they just looked up at the stars, played connect the dots, and declared that there was meaning in what they saw or imagined they saw. If a modern-day astrologer claims to rely on some book or source documents, ask for titles. Ask where it or they came from. Ask for early sources that do not simply describe astrology but also explain its origins and how it functions in a way that makes sense. Follow the trail back far enough, however, and it always leads to a familiar place, human imagination. Astrology is layer upon layer of made-up stuff. This is not science. Its predictive powers do not exist. Astrology has nothing to do with the stars and planets of outer space. It has everything to do with the biases and delusions of human inner space. Astrology's second fundamental problem is that nobody seems to know how it is supposed to work. It just does, is the most common explanation I hear from believers. Astrology may have been important to the development of early astronomy, and it may have even been useful in keeping time and developing early agriculture. However, as it is practiced and believed in today, it's pure pseudoscience. There is no underlying theory that explains it, no body of knowledge that supports it, and no set of experiments that confirm it. I know this because I have asked professional astrologers. I listened with an open mind, and when told that my status as a Libra meant that one thing or another would happen to me and that I was inclined to think and feel this way or that, I asked how they know this. Because the stars say so is not an answer, of course. Why do the stars say this? How do the stars say this? These are the simple questions that need to be answered, but never are. I suspect that many believers imagine there must be some vast collection of data stored in the vaults of a giant astrology archive somewhere that serves as the source material for all the horoscopes written today. Or maybe they think there is some centralized Supreme Council of Astrologers that generates the calculations all astrologers base their work on. But there are none of these things. A final point that everyone should be aware of is that horoscopes are popular and work well for so many people because most of them are written in ways that allow virtually everyone and anyone to recognize something that feels unique and special to them. A good horoscope writer can craft 50 words or so that will feel personal and specific to the individual reading or hearing it, no matter who that individual is. If something is known about the person in advance and the horoscope can be personalized, even better. It's like psychics with their cold readings. Focus on challenges and concerns common to most of us, and those who are predisposed to believe will think it must apply to them in some special way. As far as predicting things about the future, two things help that along, vague predictions and confirmation bias. A prediction like, you will enjoy financial gain this week, could mean winning the lottery, finding $5 on a sidewalk, or nothing more than getting your weekly paycheck. For most believers, confirmation bias will ensure that astrology's relatively few successful predictions are remembered, and its many failures forgotten. When someone tells me how awesome astrology is, I don't argue. I just ask a few questions and pay close attention to the answers. Try it. Ask how the stars and planets go about influencing and predicting the course of our lives. What is the force behind this? How does it work? Is it gravity? If so, how can that be when a potted plant in the room exerts more gravitational force on you than a distant planet? Ask them why it is that people born in October have different personalities and talents than people born in December. Don't let them ramble on about all the ways in which they are different. You want to know why they are different. Asking these important questions and not allowing yourself to be sidetracked by hollow answers are key to becoming a good skeptic and staying focused on reality. Miracles. Miracle belief is extremely popular. Just look around. Just listen. Miracles are everywhere. One can hardly walk down the street or turn on a television without hearing someone claim that a miracle has occurred. According to Harris Poll, 76% of American adults believe in miracles. But believing in miracles is easy. Thinking about miracles takes a bit of work, and despite all the talk, most people don't bother. They just seem to accept them as a fact of life without question. But a good skeptic doesn't believe in something only because most people around her say it's true. Miracles are generally thought to be supernatural events caused by a god, a magical being, or a person with special unnatural powers. According to various believers, miracles can be bizarre feats that defy the normal workings of nature. They can also be natural events that are intentionally orchestrated to bring about desired outcomes. So a miracle might be a natural rainstorm that a pious farmer's prayers bring on just in time to save his crop, or it could be a god or preacher bringing a dead man with rigor mortis back to life by supernatural means. Maybe miracles really do happen, I don't know, but I am sure that the claims of miracles that I hear about are obvious cases of people failing to think critically and be good skeptics. Just because something is unexpected, unusual, or extraordinarily well-timed does not necessarily mean that it is a magical event. Of course weird things happen all the time. Wouldn't it be strange if nothing strange ever happened? A key problem people have when thinking about miracles comes from the fact that we aren't natural mathematicians. Most people in the world never take a class in statistics or even pause to consider how likely it is for unlikely events to occur. Just consider, for example, that there are 7 billion people alive right now. Let's imagine some quirky event that happens every day, but at a very low rate. Let's say this event has a 1 in a billion chance of happening to you or me on any given day. It probably won't happen to us, but will happen to 7 people every day. Those 7 people are probably going to feel extremely lucky or unlucky, depending on what it is. But it was going to happen to somebody. Even a rare daily event with 1 in a million odds of happening to you or me sounds unlikely, right? But 7,000 people would experience the event each day. Over the course of just 1 year, 2,555,000 people would experience it. It's the same with lotteries. The chances of winning those things tend to be astronomically small, but people do win them virtually every day nonetheless. No doubt, the winners feel very special, and many of them likely conclude that they must have been on the receiving end of a miracle. But when you consider those few winners in the context of all the losers, it becomes clear that nothing magical necessarily occurred. Somebody was going to win because lotteries are designed to produce winners. If you are prone to believing in miracles, and you think some things happen that just can't be explained as anything other than the work of a god, then try to imagine being in very different circumstances. Transport yourself into the body of a typical Pleistocene human 100 centuries ago. You are living in a time before Google, Wikipedia, and soap. Your clothing, footwear, and scent will change, but biologically you are no different. Mentally and physically you are the same. What you are missing out on, however, is the convenience of being able to call on 100,000 years of accumulated human knowledge and scientific discovery. It's gone. All you have now is the potential to reason for yourself and figure things out. You also have whatever skills and awareness your prehistoric peers passed on to you around nightly campfire gatherings. Suddenly, a nearby volcano erupts. The ground shakes. A strange orange and black goo flows down the mountain. When it comes into contact with trees, they burst into fire. Smoke and dust darken the sky. You are terrified but also desperately curious. What is going on? How can this be happening? It makes no sense. All you have are questions and no answers. You are smart, but you know nothing of geology, volcanology, the layers of the earth, magma, lava, and so on. You can't simply ask someone else to explain what is going on because no one on the entire planet knows. What do? You might have a flash of insight and come up with a respectable guess about the earth's fiery underbelly releasing a bit of pressure. But even then, you couldn't be sure. No one can look at an erupting volcano for the first time and explain it sensibly and fully with absolutely no knowledge of geology to draw from. So maybe out of frustration, you would do what everyone around you is doing. Explain the volcano as the work of gods or magic. The gods did it, and it's a miracle has probably been the most common quick answer to every mystery faced by people since the dawn of language. But from the perspective of your presence in the 21st century, you know that a volcano can be explained by natural forces and doesn't require the involvement of gods or magical forces. Nothing would have changed about you from the Pleistocene and now, other than the availability of a natural explanation. This is key because as natural explanations come, supernatural explanations go. This has been the pattern for thousands of years. Magical explanations lose their appeal when they just aren't necessary anymore. Thousands of years ago, who wouldn't have thought that a solar eclipse was a miracle? Today, however, fewer people in most societies feel the need to invoke magic as an explanation for them. Nothing changed in nature, only our knowledge of astronomy did. Perhaps patience is the first thing we should think of when faced with unanswered questions. If the past is a guide, many of today's miracles probably won't seem so miraculous in the future. It should not be interpreted as insulting or rude to point out that ignorance drives many specific miracle claims and the general belief in them. Ignorance doesn't mean stupidity or intellectual dimness. It only refers to a lack of specific knowledge needed to understand something in a given situation. We are all ignorant of many, many things, of course. What matters is how we choose to react to our ignorance when it stares us in the face. Some of us freely admit that we do not know some things and proceed accordingly. Others, however, attempt to hide their ignorance under a tent of made-up answers. It seems to be human nature, or an irresistible impulse, for us to explain things even when we can't, so we make up answers. We fill in the blanks with miracle. But here's a critical truth every good skeptic knows. It's okay to say, I don't know. Really, it's fine. I understand that it can be difficult at times, but this is how humans ought to operate. If I were out walking my dog and an autographed first edition copy of Mark Twain's The Innocents Abroad suddenly fell from the sky and landed at my feet, I would be challenged to come up with a natural explanation. It fell out of a passing airplane currently being leased by a wealthy collector of rare books. It was swept up into the stratosphere by a tornado in Oklahoma and then it blew over to my state before tumbling earthward. Some juvenile delinquent stole it from the Twain Museum in Hannibal, Missouri, and then traveled to my neighborhood so that he could throw it at me while perched in a nearby tree? All sound and reasonable possibilities, of course, but none of those would probably be the right answer. Maybe I would just have to live the rest of my life with a nagging mystery, one that gnaws at me every time I hear the name Mark Twain or look at that book on my shelf. As a good skeptic, however, I am sure that I wouldn't cheat by pretending to know that the gods tossed it down to me as a gift. I wouldn't do that because I couldn't possibly know such a thing. Mysteries are not miracles. Ancient alien astronauts. Did space travelers from a distant world visit the Earth during ancient or prehistoric times? Did they interact with the people, influence their engineering, art, and religious beliefs, and perhaps even interbreed with them to supercharge our evolution? Maybe. Who knows? I can't say for sure that it didn't happen. What I do know is that no one has ever proved this amazing story or even presented any good evidence for it. Chariots of the Gods, a 1968 book written by a former hotel manager named Erich von Däniken, is more responsible than anything or anyone else for making this claim so popular. It was an international bestseller when it first came out decades ago, and it is still selling today. But why? Surely people would not just accept a claim this wild without rock-solid proof, right? No, they would, and they do. Apparently, it doesn't matter that virtually every professional archaeologist in the world rejects this claim. Nor does it seem to make any difference that every single argument von Däniken made has been thoroughly addressed and demolished by experts. People seem to like this idea of ancient aliens visiting us so much that they can't resist boarding the chariot. I won't go into detail about the numerous problems with the ancient astronaut claim. Those who want more can read the chapter about it in my book, 50 Popular Beliefs That People Think Are True. The point I want to make here is that this story is rooted in a view of our ancestors that is both inaccurate and detestable. Von Däniken and others who promote this belief push the premise that prehistoric and ancient people were hopelessly dim and could never have done the things anthropologists and historians say they did. These were such bumbling idiots that they had to have had extraterrestrial help in order to get anything done. If not for the advanced visitors, it's clear that we would all still be grunting at one another in dark caves or up in trees. Here's a small sample of claims made about ancient people found in Chariots of the Gods. In the Subis Mountains on the west coast of Borneo, a network of caves was found that had been hollowed out on a cathedral-like scale. Among these colossal finds, there are fabrics of such fineness and delicacy that with the best will in the world one cannot imagine savages making them. The Great Pyramid is a visible testimony of a technique that has never been understood. Today, in the 20th century, no architect could build a copy of the Pyramid of Cheops, even if the technical resources of every continent were at his disposal. Where did the narrators of the Thousand and One Nights get their staggering wealth of ideas? How did anyone come to describe a lamp from which a magician spoke when its owner wished? It's an embarrassing story. In advanced cultures of the past, we find buildings that we cannot copy today with the most modern technical means. Not only are these assertions condescending, but also they're just plain wrong. First of all, anatomically modern people have been around for at least 200,000 years or so. This means that people with brains as capable and creative as ours were here for more than 195,000 years before the Great Pyramids of Giza were built and stories like the Thousand and One Nights were written. Interestingly, prehistoric people had slightly bigger brains than we do today, and they might have been more intelligent. This makes sense when you consider how unforgiving life would have been for Stone Age dimwits. Most would have been selected out of the gene pool early by poisonous berries, falling rocks, and hungry predators. Today, however, the dimmest not only survive at high rates, but some of them belong to an extremely successful subspecies known as celebrities and star in reality TV shows. No one with any sense has ever suggested that we went from Australopithecines sleeping in trees to Homo sapiens building pyramids in one flash of insight. A lot happened between Homo erectus and the reign of Khufu. The progression of technology was not so unusual that it requires extraterrestrials to explain it. In short, there is nothing about ourselves or our past that indicates that we were incapable of doing the things we did. And, contrary to what von Daniken says and writes, we could in the past and can today build a giant pyramid if we wanted to. Researchers have even demonstrated ways in which people might have moved and placed large stone blocks using only ancient technology and muscle. There is no doubt it could be done with modern technology. Even within Egypt, the progression is evident. The three famous pyramids at Giza did not spring up from the sands in a way that defied the flow of ancient Egyptian history. I have visited the nearby pyramid of Djoser at Saqqara, for example, and this older pyramid is precisely what one would expect to see. It's huge and impressive, yet less of a technical and artistic achievement compared with the pyramids that followed. What are we to believe? That less intelligent and less capable aliens helped the Egyptians at Saqqara earlier, and then, years later, slightly more sophisticated aliens lent a hand at Giza to produce the superior pyramids? The end of the world. Writing about science can open one up to a universe of opportunities. For example, I regularly get invites to talk about everything from astronomy to zombies. In 2012, I was one of the speakers at Doomsday Live, a radio show and live audience theater event organized by the SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute. It was a slick production, hosted by the Computer Science Museum in Mountain View, California. The topics seemed thrilling enough to me: asteroid strikes, viral plagues, rebellious computers, environmental chaos, irrational doomsday predictions, and more. But it might easily have been a disaster about disasters. I wasn't sure how people would react. Fortunately, it turned out to be one great apocalyptic spectacle. The live audience was one of the warmest and most enthusiastic I have ever spoken to. At times, I felt like I was at a Super Bowl bash or maybe one of those Tony Robbins seminars. Yeah, there is just something about the end of the world that picks up a party. But I should have expected it, because this is nothing new. Apocalyptic fears and fantasies have intrigued, excited, burdened, and haunted humankind for millennia. I would not be surprised if Homo erectus bands often paused between hunting and gathering to worry about the end of the world, too. Maybe caves were the first doomsday bunkers and cavemen the first doomsday preppers. What is certain is that we have a strong and enduring interest in a final day of reckoning that borders on obsession. Just note the steady flow of films, books, and television shows with apocalyptic themes in pop culture today. Numerous religions, past and present, were built on a foundation of end-of-the-world threats and promises of escape. Science has done its part, too, by providing several charming evidence-based doomsday scenarios for us to contemplate at bedtime. I understand the appeal. Horrible as global death and destruction may be, there is also a certain attraction to it for some people who think the idea of hitting the reset button might not be so bad. No more rent or mortgage payments to worry about. No lame job to show up for anymore. The end of the world, human extinction, and the collapse of civilization are all interesting subjects for the skeptic, because the world really could end and take us with it. It's not an entirely crazy topic. For example, gamma rays, a nearby supernova, and solar flares are no joke. They are all real things that do happen. One event could scorch us into oblivion. Some threats are not only possible or likely to happen, they will happen. Wandering rocks in space called asteroids will threaten to devastate our planet and destroy most life here one day, just as they have done in the past. Right now, we know there are approximately 1 million objects in our solar system that could pose a direct threat to us one day. We might be in the crosshairs in a few years, a few decades, or a few million years from now. But it's going to happen. Supervolcanoes are thousands of times more powerful than the regular volcanoes we are familiar with. These gigantic monsters are rare, but they have erupted in the past and will erupt again. One of them, Toba in Sumatra, almost wiped us out 74,000 years ago when it spewed tons of dust and smoke into the atmosphere to darken and chill the world. The total human population may have dipped to as few as 2,000 people worldwide as a result. It is unlikely but plausible that a virus could evolve or be engineered to kill us all one day.